Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. It's Saturday. Welcome along, however you're listening, wherever you are, whether it be this Saturday afternoon across the country on Premier Christian Radio or via our podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Welcome to Unbelievable, the show for thinking Christians and non-Christians as well. We've got plenty of both sorts listening. It's great to have you with me, and I'm really pleased you could join me for today's show. I'm Justin Briley, with you through till 4 o'clock this afternoon. And let me tell you what's coming up today.
You're unbelievable.
Well, he's one of the best known Christian defenders of the faith in the UK, probably in the world, in fact. Alistair McGrath has been one of the key respondents to Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists in the last few years. We're going to be hearing a special interview I conducted with Alistair, all about his life, his ministry, his theology. It's a great way to spend your afternoon in the company of one of the masters of faith and defence of the faith here in the UK, Alistair McGrath. Now, don't forget, towards the end of the programme, we'll be hearing some of your feedback, and I'm leaving plenty of time at the end of today's programme because an awful lot of response to last week's programme, which featured Bishop Jack Spong, and we'll be hearing some of that later on. But right now, time to jump into this interview, and this was recorded at the office of Alistair McGrath at King's College London, and you'll hear some a photographer snapping away in the background as well, so I hope that doesn't distract too much, but this is because it was also written up as a piece for Christianity magazine. You can find that in their December issue for 2009, the interview with Alistair McGrath. Happy listening as I speak to Alistair McGrath on his life, his faith, and his apologetics. Let's start off with your two roles, really, that you've had in life, a scientist and as a theologian. Many people would say that those are two completely different arenas to be working in. What do you say to that?
Well, I must admit, I would have thought that once myself. When I was studying the sciences as a schoolboy, of course, I was really quite an aggressive atheist. And for me, the idea that science had anything to say to religion other than you are dreadfully wrong would just make no sense at all. And I think really what happened was I went up to Oxford to study the sciences. I began studying chemistry, then did a doctorate in the field of biology, and became a Christian. And so obviously, establishing the link between my faith and the natural sciences was a very big issue for me. And it was a very challenging and I think very exciting journey of exploration for me to try and work out what the relationship between these two things was. And certainly there are those, such as Richard Dawkins, who would say that science leads to atheism. But I think Dawkins there speaks as an atheist, not as a scientist. And in many ways, one of my visions is to try and get us to a point where we can look at science not through these dogmatic atheist spectacles, which you find in Dawkins and The Independent and The Guardian, and I have to say also the BBC, but rather to say, look, let's try and look at this afresh. For me, there's a real synergy between science and faith, and I find that very exciting.
Mm. So coming back to your story of coming to faith, you were an atheist. What was it that you would say brought you to faith in Christianity in Jesus?
I think there are a number of things. And obviously, it's very difficult to look back on the past and try and work out exactly what was triggered off a certain line of thought. But what I can say is that I arrived at Oxford University as an 18-year-old person, going to study chemistry, very, very excited about this, but also being very open-minded and feeling one keeps the big questions of life under review. And I began to re-examine my atheism, which I had held for some years very trenchantly, and began to realise, I think to my disquiet, that the evidence for this was much weaker than I'd thought. And alongside this, I also began to talk to Christian friends, read some Christian books, attend some Christian lectures. I think I began to realize that actually the intellectual case for faith was much stronger than I'd realized. In fact, if I go further than that, really, I think I had not fully understood the Christianity I had rejected as a younger man. And I began to realize I had a lot of rethinking to do. And I think what drew me to faith initially was this very deep sense that this made much more sense of the world and my experience than anything else. Certainly much more sense than atheism. And later I came across a quote from C.S. Lewis, which I now look back on, and it frames that event very, very well. But I didn't know this at the time. Where Lewis says at the end of his essay, "Is Theology Poetry?" "I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen. Not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." And that spoke to me of the double rationality of faith. Faith makes sense in itself, but it makes sense of everything else as well. And that really drew me to faith in a very big way. I've moved on since then. My faith is much deeper now, but that, I think, was what drew me in.
And in a sense, you were obviously a very thinking person. Your faith had to be thought through. At what point, as it were, did you have to kind of make a leap of faith as well, as it were, experience something that's subjective and not just sort of objectively thinking about
it? Yes, I think that's a very good question. And certainly you're right. I'm a very rational thinking person. And that meant that my initial grasp of faith was actually primarily intellectual. This makes sense. I went on to discover the relational, the emotional, the imaginative aspects of faith later as part of my journey of faith. But what got me at the beginning was, this makes sense. You're also right that there came a point where I had to make a leap of faith, where I had to say, look, all the evidence points in this direction, but it doesn't take me the final yards. You know, there's a gap. There's a gap. The evidence takes me thus far. At some point, I've got to say, I need to commit myself, and by doing so, I go beyond the available evidence. I think there are two things I'd want to say here. One is that the same is true of any worldview, even atheism. I mean, that there is no proof there is no God. Let's be absolutely clear about that. I think Dawkins does find himself severely embarrassed by the fact. He has to kind of way ramp up the rhetoric to carry the reader along at that point. So whatever you are, whether you are an atheist or a Christian or politically a conservative, a liberal or a socialist, there comes a point where you have to say, look, I believe this, even though the evidence doesn't take me all the way. So we're all in the same boat. But secondly, and most importantly of all, having made that leap of faith and looking back, it wasn't really that big a leap. Actually, it made perfect sense. It's a bit like somebody walking in the dark who manages to find their way to a place and then dawn breaks and they realize, actually, it wasn't that hard to get there. And really what I'd want to say is, looking back on my leap of faith from the standpoint of faith, A, I'm very glad I made that leap, but B, it wasn't really a leap into the dark. There's much more everything pointing in this direction. All I did was walk the final few yards on my own.
I mean, from the sounds of it, there's still, in a sense, quite a scientific approach to that, in as much as it's what drew you, certainly at least, was that this worldview best explains the data you have in front of you, better explains it certainly than an atheistic worldview. I mean, what is it about the Christian worldview that for you makes much more sense on that level than an atheist worldview?
Well, I like that question. And certainly, for me, there are various areas of life that you can shine the spotlight of faith. One is the whole scientific enterprise. I feel very strongly that the Christian faith, which talks about a God who makes the world in an orderly way, but also fashions us after his own image, so we're able to, in effect, reflect on this. That really does make an awful lot of sense of the scientific enterprise. And certainly, I was reading Francis Collins' book, The Language of God, and Collins, as you probably know, is a very well-known American scientist, head of the Human Genome Project now, a very key person in President Obama's team. And he says in that book, look, I was an atheist, I became a Christian, my faith makes far more sense of science than my old atheism used to. And I'd agree with that. But of course, there's much more to it than that. This human experience, this human culture. And for me, one of the amazing things about faith is it helps us to deal with why it is that human beings are longing for significance, why we invest so heavily in things that don't deliver. And help us to see this in the light of being created by God, but fallen. So we are empty, we're longing for God, we put other things in God's place, they don't satisfy, we get very dissatisfied. And for me, one of the great attractions of C.S. Lewis is his ability to give us a framework for making sense of experience. And that seems to be hugely important. Whether I look at the sciences, my own experience, reason, or culture, I see something that the Christian grid or framework is able to make sense of.
You are married to a theologian as well, I think. Is the McGrath household a hotbed of theological debate most of the time?
My wife and I often talk about theology, and I think we talk about in two major contexts. One is because we're both writing books, so we very often swap notes. But also, of course, we're both ordained ministers in the Church of England, and therefore we both preach every Sunday, so very often we compare notes on sermons. So it's a very stimulating environment.
Speaking of your ordination, I mean, you, I think, spent time as a curate, but you've gone into a more academic route now. Were you ever tempted to full-time pastoral ministry?
Oh, yes. And in fact, that was my initial intention. I actually began to study theology because I knew it would be useful for going into ministry. What I did not expect to happen was discovering that theology was so exciting. That took me by surprise. I thought it was like learning the basics of car mechanics. It was something, a tool, which you had to acquire. I didn't realize it would be so fulfilling intellectually, and therefore I began to realize that my true vocation might lie partly in being a teacher. But I certainly see parish ministry as being enormously important. And although my full-time job is as professor at King's College London, on Sundays I help out in parishes and preach. So I'm able to actually have both worlds, which is very exciting.
Yes, I mean, I imagine some people might conceive of the ivory tower sort of theology professor as being somewhat disconnected from the real life of theology. So tinkering with the mechanics but not driving the car very much. I mean, is there a danger of that when you are, as it were, in this area?
I think there is a danger, and I'm always aware that as a theologian, I'm thinking about things that, frankly, a lot of people couldn't care less about, and that is a real danger. But on the other hand, more of my job at King's College is to help clergy deepen their own understanding of their faith, make more sense of their ministry, and do their jobs better. And so my natural tendency these days is to ask, what is the practical value of this idea I'm exploring? How would I preach this? How does this enable me or my many friends to be better pastors? So if you like, I'm always approaching theology from the standpoint of the user. I'm saying, how does this work out in practice? How would I teach this? What difference does this make to the way I live my life? And that is, I think, a very helpful orientation. It means I'm grounded, not, closeted away in an ivory tower, but rather someone who works with people of faith, who's responding to their questions and trying to give answers that make me satisfied as well as satisfy them.
Ephesians 4:11 says, it was he who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, and some to be pastors and teachers. Which are you, or are you some kind of combination?
I think I'm a bit of a muddled person. I mean, there are many things I like doing. And sometimes we end up doing things that we like rather than things we're good at. I enjoy teaching enormously. I enjoy writing books, and people tell me they enjoy reading them, so I write more. I also love pastoring people, and I love preaching. Maybe I don't do all those things very well, but actually they matter to me, and I just count it a huge privilege to be able to do things that matter to me, whereas I know many of my friends have to do 9-to-5 jobs which they find very miserable, and then they come home and they do what they really want to do. I just am in this wonderful position of doing things that I think matter and that I enjoy doing.
You've spent much of your life among students. What does that do for you? Does it sort of keep you in touch with the kinds of questions that people are very often asking? Student days are very often the point at which you start to sort through the issues of whether you believe in God and that sort of
yes.
thing.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And certainly it is very, very good to keep interacting with students, partly because they raise the questions that I was raising when I was a student, partly because they're also raising new questions that need to be thought about. We're going through major cultural change. And there is a sense in which a vibrant student engagement stops you becoming complacent, stops you recycling the answers you used 25 years ago. You're always being kept on your toes, so that you're being forced to reopen questions and see, can I give better answers than those I gave 5 or 10 years ago? So actually, I welcome this very much indeed. I love the intellectual curiosity of students. I love the students who come up to me and say, we've read Dawkins, but he's so simplistic, it just can't be this simple. Tell us what the answers are. And that to me is a really exciting thing. They can see through this incredibly simplistic dogmatic atheism, and they want better answers. I try to give them. I'm not sure if I give them very well, but I'm trying to improve on this all the time.
You've, of course, been a principal respondent in the Christian world to Richard Dawkins.
Yes.
And the new atheism generally. Is atheism on the rise? Because certainly in your 2004 book, The Twilight of Atheism, you were saying the opposite, really, that atheism is in decline. And yet we seem to be seeing more of atheists and very, if you like, militant atheism than ever now, don't we?
That's right. In my 2004 book, The Twilight of Atheism, I make the point that really atheism has kind of run out of ideas. And therefore I make the point right at the end of the book that actually what happens to atheism is not going to be shaped by its ideas, but by cultural developments. If the culture shifts so that people feel that religion is having a bigger profile than it should, then my argument is atheism will enjoy a resurgence. That actually is what really I think has happened. The driving force for many atheists I speak to is the presidency of George W. Bush, which seems to them to represent the rise of a very religious worldview in American politics and beyond, which they see as a threat. And I think the stridency, the aggressiveness of much atheism is actually a response to this. I'm wondering what's going to happen now that George Bush has been replaced by Barack Obama. What I found very, very interesting is looking at Barack Obama's speeches leading up to his endorsement as Democratic candidate. He affirms his faith in a very, very strong way. And certainly many atheists have been deeply distressed by that. I think it's very, very interesting. My own feeling is this, that actually the new atheism is not really very new. It's the old arguments recycled. What is new is the aggressiveness. And what I think is interesting is this. Certainly you're right. It's a much stronger cultural presence. But because of that, it itself is now attracting a level of scrutiny and examination which it did not attract in the past. And the judgment of many is that atheism is dogmatic, it's aggressive, it's simplistic, and actually it's not the sort of thing we want. It's almost like a new form of religious fundamentalism, and that is simply what people want to move away from as quickly as possible.
I mean, that was the subtitle of your book, your own short response, as it were, to Dawkins, the Dawkins Delusion. I think it was, what was the subtitle? Atheist Fundamentalism, or the...
And the Denial of the Divine. That's
yes.
Right, yes.
Now, Richard Dawkins, well known for his work in biology, latterly carving out a name for himself as the arch-atheist of Britain, or the world, in fact. I personally find sometimes the attitude quite arrogant. I mean, I know that he describes, and his followers describe, books such as the ones you've written as the works of fleas, i.e. feeding off his success and a kind of a slightly annoying itch, you know. I mean, what's your response to the way that they sort of conduct the discussion?
Well, I think if you initiate a debate, you've got to expect other people to want to join in. Especially if you initiate a debate by flagrantly misrepresenting the other side and making arguments which, frankly, are indefensible. And so all I was doing was simply saying, look, this is what Richard Dawkins says, but actually this is right. So I failed to see what is wrong with saying this is right. I was saying the emperor has no clothes. And certainly Dawkins does appear to have been really quite annoyed by this and treats me as simply some insignificant person who's trying to gain some kudos by engaging with the great, great and mighty figure that he is, and thus, in effect, drawing attention to myself by doing so. I think all I saw myself as doing was simply putting my hand up and saying, if you don't mind, can I just ask some awkward questions? I'm sort of a whistleblower. And I think that there are now so many whistleblowers. I mean, we've seen some major works, particularly by Terry Eagleton, simply making the point that both Richard Dawkins and his fellow traveller, Christopher Hitchens, have in effect produced works of such gross intellectual superficiality that really they do need to be challenged. I am very, very glad to have handed the baton on to other people. I myself am moving on to other things. I don't think the New Atheism is very interesting. Others, I think, are making a much better response. And I suspect that actually this movement is beginning to wane. It's lost its novelty value. What the media like is novelty, and I'm afraid that's on its way out.
But one can't help feeling that a lot of people must be being influenced. I mean, the God Delusion has been a bestseller. And the danger, I suppose, is, from a Christian point of view, that that may be the only interaction someone has with these arguments, and they're going to get a very obviously one-sided view of the discussion. And is the Christian church doing enough to respond? Is our voice being heard in response to this new wave of atheism?
I don't think it is doing enough. I think the difficulty I have is I'm not quite clear what it could be doing to improve things. There's no doubt that the surge of works by Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens took the church by surprise. And I don't think they really were very well equipped to respond to it. My feeling is that the church now understands that there is an urgent need for its leaders, its pastors, to be equipped apologetically. And that means being able to engage with these questions, give good responses, and above all, equip ordinary Christians to answer their friends' questions. In other words, the Christian who says, look, my friends read the God Delusion, what do I say to it? Their pastors need to be doing that. There's a real need for more apologetics in the church. And I'd want to say that institutions like the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics are playing a vital role in equipping people to do this. That's something that really needs to be done. I expect there'll be other challenges in the years that lie ahead, and maybe we need to try and second guess what they might be so we can prepare a defence in advance. My real concern is that the Christian Church always is so reactive that by the time it's got round to responding to the Da Vinci Code, something else has come along, like Richard Dawkins. What else is coming along? I don't really know, but we won't be ready for it.
Yes. I mean, you might see it as, in a sense, a good thing. People are at least asking questions where they might not have really thought about the issues before, and it might be being given more opportunity for people to introduce the concept of God to those who perhaps...
Well, that is a very fair point. And certainly one of the, I think, unintended consequences of the publication of God Delusion and others is that people are now very happy to talk about God. It's much easier to talk about God now than it was 10 years ago. It's a sort of legitimate item for discussion, and I certainly welcome that. I think that there is a... People want to talk about this, and the very fact that the God Delusion had to be written is actually a telling indication that God has a much greater survival value than anyone realized. I think that when atheism has to degenerate to bus advertisements, it is actually in quite a bad way, because it implies that people actually need help to realize this. Whereas, in fact, I would want to say that really atheism is almost like a little church, a little religion of its own, with its high priests, its infallible texts. And actually, those high priests and infallible texts are now being looked at with great scrutiny. And what is being found out, I think, really does raise some very interesting questions.
And in a sense, atheism, as you say, has its own dogmas, its own creeds. And anyone who disagrees with that is sort of an outcast in some respects, at least in certain circles. I mean, is this kind of what you see then, is this atheist fundamentalism, this idea that it itself has massive presuppositions as much as it accuses other worlds.
I think that's right. I mean, some atheists say, well, of course, we can't be fundamentalists because we don't read religious texts. But that, I think, is to miss the point of what fundamentalism is. Fundamentalism is a very dogmatic mindset, which in effect divides the world in two, the saved and the damned. The saved are those who are illuminated, who are right, and they are the saints, the people who wear white. Then there's a mass of people who are fools, who are those who are, you know, either going to hell or those who are, you know, idiots. And certainly, I'm afraid, the new atheism does show that. Its utter contempt for its opponents, I think, really does bring home to people that this is not simply an intellectual option. This is something which is so deeply embedded that anyone who challenges it is a threat, because, in effect, it is a very vulnerable movement. So I find its dogmatism actually very predictable, and it just makes it very, very clear, I think, that here is a religion in its own right. As I said, it has its own popes, its own sacred texts. You're not allowed to challenge those. I was at a very interesting discussion the other day with some students here at King's, and we were just talking about some various things. And I said, of course, you know, Dawkins does make quite a few mistakes in The God Delusion, let me tell you. And a student immediately said, no, that's right. That is, it's an infallible text. It's right. You can't say he's wrong. I said, well, why not? He is. And he said, well, if you do, my life will fall to pieces because I've kind of way built my life on that book. Well, I think that's interesting. What I'd love to know is how many other people are in that kind of situation.
A lot of this does take place in the sort of debate halls and that sort of thing, but Christianity is more than just winning an argument, isn't it?
Well, I personally think that there is a real issue here about what faith is all about. And the new atheism takes faith to be purely cognitive, purely intellectual. And they fail to realize its relational, its existential, its emotional, its imaginative dimensions. And that point is very often made against Richard Dawkins, who seems to treat religion simply as an explanation of things. It's far more than that. But I think what I would want to say is that there is so much more to faith than simply ideas. It goes much, much deeper than that. The debate is happening at the level of ideas, I concede. But actually, what very often draws people to faith is not so much its ideas as the very strong feeling, here is something that gives meaning to my life. And I think Christians need to think more about the way in which their faith transforms existence, giving you a new understanding of who you are, the difference you can make, purpose in life, your value, and so on. And those seem to me to be enormously important things. You're right, there are these debates going on, but elsewhere in culture, there are these personal conversations. What is the meaning of life? Why am I here? And we need to be part of those conversations.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we'll be back to hear more of that interview in just a moment's time here on Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show. This is Unbelievable, and dispensing with our normal format of Christian, non-Christian discussion just for this week, as we give time over to a special sort of in-depth interview with Alistair McGrath, who many will know for his apologetics work, for his theological work. And this interview taken at his office in King's College, London. Let's get back into it now.
One of the things that strikes me, and forgive me for dwelling so long on this area, but I think it's one that is so important to many people, but Dawkins and co. are almost willing to accept grudgingly the idea possibly of a sort of deistic God, the idea that, you know, they'll kind of, you know, if you have that kind of concept, they won't look down on you maybe too much, though they'll certainly disagree with it. It's when you come to positing actual Christian doctrines like the Trinity, like Jesus being God incarnate, like the miraculous, like the resurrection, that's where they see the miraculous and interventionist God as completely anti-scientific. What is there a problem here? Are miracles just so contrary to the normal order of things that they are in some sense anti-scientific? They do jar against a scientific understanding of the world.
Yes, that's a very interesting question. Let me just begin by making the point that in many ways what the new atheism is trying to do is create the cultural presumption that religious faith is irrational, reprehensible and anti-scientific. And we need to challenge that, I think, quite strongly. But let's take up this point about miracles. I mean, in many ways, a miracle is something which takes us by surprise, which is difficult to understand, which seems to go against the expected order of things. It's very difficult to give a definition of miracle. And actually, when you look at the New Testament, I mean, there is no doubt that things are happening which you and I would probably describe as miracles. What's important is usually not so much the miracle itself as what it points to. Jesus does these healings, so who is he? But for me, looking at science, I look at things like the origins of the universe, where something comes into existence from nothing. And you have this idea that the universe was the size of a grapefruit at one point. And I mean, that's just impossible to understand. And again, you know, it really beggars belief, if I can put it like that. This seems to be what's happening. Isn't that a miracle? Something astonishing, which actually reason simply can't take in. And what I want to say is that actually, in many ways, there are things which I personally would come close to describing as miraculous, like planting a seed in the ground and a plant grows. The only reason it's not miraculous is I got used to this. So there is, I think, a real question here about how we approach these. Many Christians have argued that actually the idea of miracles doesn't cause scientific difficulty if it's rightly understood. And personally, I would want to say that that we need to be careful as Christians how we talk about miracles, because it can easily get people's hackles up. But rightly understood, it's an important idea.
In terms of your personal faith journey, since becoming a Christian, and you say your faith has deepened hugely in that time, have you ever had periods of doubt where you've honestly wondered, is it all in my imagination? Am I really deluded?
Well, certainly. In my early time as a Christian, I would often wonder, you know, have I made a big mistake here? Because I'm a very intellectually honest person. I'd often, you know, challenge myself, saying, look, why do you believe this? And if I couldn't give a good answer, you know, I'd be worried. And I think actually that's one of the reasons why I've ended up being a Christian apologist, because I had to be an apologist to myself before I could be an apologist to anybody else. There are times, I will freely admit, when I look at the way in which the church behaves and I think, my goodness, you know, why am I a member of this organisation? I sort of put my head in my hands. Then I look at the sheer intellectual arrogance of atheism and think, oh my God, there are even worse things out there, which I think helps to set things in context. For me, actually, I'll be very clear that it's not so much the ideas of Christianity that cause problems, it's the way Christians behave. And actually, that's what people notice. And I think that the Christian church perhaps has not been the best ambassador for the Christian gospel that it could be.
So the things that have made you doubt or given you the most despair has actually been the behaviour rather than what Christianity posits. It's actually the outworking of it which
well, that is right. Maybe I'm not typical in this respect. But a question that often goes through my mind is, if God is so good, why are his followers so awful? You know, I mean, I'm sure I'm just as bad as anyone else. But I do sometimes wonder why it is that some Christians who take upon themselves leadership positions very often don't quite seem to have the personal qualities that I would expect. Mm. I would expect a leader to be Christ-like. Sometimes I see leaders as really not exhibiting that quality at all.
Nonetheless, God can work even through broken human vessels, I suppose.
Absolutely, and I'm just so grateful that God more than adequately compensates for human weakness. He's able to take even weak and foolish people and do great and wonderful things in them and through them. I just sometimes wonder, you know, why doesn't he hurry up and regenerate people more quickly?
As we finish on the subject of the miraculous, I suppose, you know, the most central miracle in Christianity is the resurrection. And Dawkins and Co., specifically, I'm thinking of Dawkins when I've heard him in debate, and the subject of the resurrection has come up. He's tended to sort of refer to it as being tawdry and provincial and, you know, sort of can't understand why it would be even be worthy of, you know, discussion. Why is it such a central thing to you?
Well, let's just begin by asking why Dawkins uses words like being provincial. Dawkins is a child of the Enlightenment. Therefore, everything has to be universally accessible to human reason. The idea that God might intervene at this moment in human history to change it completely just doesn't fit his way of thinking at all. He's so locked into this Enlightenment mindset, he can't let this challenge it. I think we've all moved beyond the Enlightenment. What intrigues me is that as I read all the representatives of the new Enlightenment, of the new atheism, they all say, let's go back to the Enlightenment. Well, I'm sorry, we've been there, we've done that, it doesn't work, we've moved on. why does the resurrection matter to me? Well, A, because I think here is something which clearly the New Testament describes as being of central importance. It transformed people's ways of thinking. It meant they saw the death of Christ in a new light, but also our own deaths in a new light. And for me, the resurrection is the climax, the culmination of God's long involvement with human history that begins with the calling of Abraham, continues through the calling of Israel, through the life, death, and then finally the resurrection of Christ. It's saying, in effect, God is bringing about a new order of which we are part, which is not limited by history, but it's all about being brought into the new Jerusalem. For me, the resurrection allows me to live this life in hope. It means that I do my best to serve people in this life, but I know that actually one day I'm going to be in another place, in a better place, with God. And that for me is something that really keeps me going as I journey through this life. I keep thinking ahead, anticipating, and thinking one day I'll be there, but in the meantime, lots of other things to be getting on with.
Just finally on this, I can't help feeling that it would take more than an argument to persuade Richard Dawkins differently to his atheistic worldview. I mean, what do you think it would take? Would it take essentially some dramatic revelation, some road to Damascus experience?
I don't know. Let me make it clear. I'm very critical of Richard Dawkins' ideas, but I wouldn't want to criticise him as a person. Even though he might want to criticise me as a person, someone who is seeking fame by criticising such a noble and elevated person as him, I would not want to critique him as a person. Why not? Well, partly because I think part of the Christian way of valuing things is that I see everyone as bearing God's image, and therefore I would not dream of being disparaging or rude about anyone else. They matter to God. And also I read the New Testament. I often wonder, what were the first Christians praying to God about Saul of Tarsus? Dear God, please take this irritating person away from us. But actually, God on the whole does some rather surprising and interesting things. And so I'm very happy to wait and see what happens here. My personal view is that Richard Dawkins is so painted into his corner, so trapped, that actually he won't be able to set himself free.
Theology... has, as an academic pursuit, has often been derided by the new atheism and that sort of thing. It's been likened to studying fairies or something at a degree level. It's not testable, obviously, and evidential in the way that science is. So what's the value of theology in terms of the public sphere, apart from those who, obviously, it has spiritual significance? I mean, having it as a course in a university accessible to anyone.
I think that theology can be thought of as the critical study of what Christians believe and why. And certainly it is a very well-defined subject of study. It has every right to be present in a university scenario, and is something that more and more people want to study, which I find very, very interesting. Dawkins and others derided this kind of way of studying fairies, but actually I cannot help but think that they ought to study it more, because if they propose to critique Christianity, they first of all need to know what it is. And you may have read Terry Eagleton's withering review of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, in which he says, look, imagining Dawkins talk about theology is like someone pontificating about ornithology, having only read the British Book of Birds. You know, and really, if you want to critique something, you do need to know what it says. Paradoxically, I think Dawkins demonstrates very, very clearly the need for theology if there is to be an informed debate and dialogue in this field.
Has theology become in any sense unfashionable in academia? I mean, do those who hold especially to an evangelical Christian viewpoint, do they get looked down upon, do you feel, in academic circles?
I think theology has always been looked down on a little bit. In the past it was seen as kind of the ideology of the state church. Nowadays it's looked upon with a degree of suspicion by secularists who feel it is a lingering echo of the past. But of course it is a very popular lingering echo of the past. And actually the paradox is that although we find older academics sometimes saying, well, perhaps this is a vestige of the past. Actually, younger ones realize how important religion is in terms of faith-based organizations, in terms of public policy, and actually there's a new generation beginning to see this in a very different way. And I think that if you look, for example, at both President Obama and even Gordon Brown, you'll find that there's this realization that part of the question of how we generate social capital is by encouraging faith communities to get involved. So I think there is an issue there. But of course, the point you were making is really about evangelicals in theological circles. And certainly some evangelicals are looked down on. This would be the kind of evangelical who says, well, of course, I've been to this conference and I've been taught the Bible is absolutely clear, it teaches this, and that's the end of the discussion. And people do tend to regard that with a degree of suspicion. I have to say, rightly so, because very often these people are simply being taught very simplistic interpretations of what the Bible teaches, rather than being encouraged to read the Bible for themselves and reflect on it long and hard, and above all, look at what Christians have said about this down the ages, being confronted with the fact that very often the Christian interpretation of biblical passage changes over time. Why is that? It's not a problem at all, I want to emphasize that. But we are very often given very simplistic visions of theology which just don't stand up to pressure. And I certainly have misgivings about those. Theology is not destructive of faith. It's simply a challenge to go deeper, to ask, why do we believe this? What's the best way of stating this? And the biggest obstacle to theology, quite frankly, is Christians who come and say, we've got this all sorted out, don't need to think, big do not disturb notice on my mind. We all need to think. We can all go deeper, and our faith will be all the better for doing so.
Dawkins often comes up with a line along the lines of, you don't believe in a whole range of gods when he speaks to believers, from Zeus to Brahman. Well, I simply believe in one less god than you. How do you respond to that kind of an argument?
That is like saying, there are many possible meanings of life. Why should there be one meaning of life? Let's get rid of that and simply say there's no meaning at all. There's a debate here about what is right. I don't think Dawkins wants to duck out of that. My answer is that the best answer to what the world is all about is to say there is a creator and redeemer God. I don't care if the options on offer include 10 zillion gods or no God. The debate goes on. My answer is there's one God, and that makes more sense of anything as far as I'm concerned. That's a debate I think we need to continue.
Daniel Dennett is another key figure in this. You've debated him, I know, in certain respects. His probably best known book, Breaking the Spell, argues that religious belief has evolved in the same way as everything else on the planet has evolved, and that we're now actually outgrowing it. Why do you believe that it is the case that God made man rather than man made God, as Dennett would see it?
Well, I think Dennett's book offers us some very interesting and highly speculative explanations, none of which really have much evidence for them. He has a brilliant gift of being able to construct a very plausible argument which actually glosses over the evidential deficits. And so, for example, he says, of course, we might have a kind of spiritual sweet tooth. Mightn't we? That'll explain everything. But the evidence for that, of course, is rather more intangible than he suggests. I think there is no doubt that that human religiosity has changed over time. We could use the language of evolution, if you like. But there is a very important issue here about this distinction between belief in God and the cultural expression of that. That's one of the reasons why the New Atheism very often deliberately blurs this distinction, belief in God, religion. It's anti-religion, anti-belief in God, but actually these are not the same thing. For example, Buddhism in various forms is very religious, but it does not believe in God. And the point I'd want to make is that I think Dennett is probably right to say that the way in which we gather together as religious communities, the way in which we express our faith culturally, I'm sure has changed. I think that's right. But of course, that does not negate the idea that there's a fundamental belief which is finding various forms of cultural expression. So I think my short answer to his question is that while I concede that patterns of religious behavior have changed, the idea of belief in God is a remarkably consistent human belief since the dawn of history.
One of the main things, obviously, that the new atheists want to do is drive a wedge between science and Christian faith. But certainly in your latest book, and in many others as well, the Fine-Tuned Universe, you say the universe itself, nature, points to God's existence, acts as evidence for God's existence. Well, I mean, it's a huge area, but just in a nutshell, why do you believe that?
I think that everyone who looks at the universe is challenged to say, you know, is this just something that happens to be there that has no meaning and we shouldn't be asking questions, or should we ask questions and see where they take us? And I belong to the camp which says we ask those questions. Why is this here? What is the best way of making sense, not simply of that universe, but me within it? And for me, the fact that the universe seems to be fine-tuned for life, the fact the universe came into being, hasn't always been there, came into being, is enormously significant. How did that happen? My atheist friends will say, well, of course, we can talk about origination without creation. But I'm left a bit baffled by that distinction. Where did it come from? I think one of the points I want to make here is that if we were having this discussion 100 years ago, most scientists would have said, well, of course, the universe has always been here. That's just the way it is. The recent discovery that it happened, it came into being, is actually really quite a staggering thing. And nobody can ignore the resonance between that and the Christian vision of creation from nothing.
Mm. Creation ex nihilo.
Exactly.
As the Latin goes. But it, in a sense, you know, you don't... I know that you don't particularly approve of the concept of intelligent design in biology, in the sense of, you know, that God tinkered in the evolutionary process to bring about complex organisms or something. Isn't this intelligent design on a sort of cosmological scale, really, that God was responsible for?
Well, that's right.
Outcomes?
I mean, I personally do not have any difficulty in thinking of God as an intelligent designer. My critique of the intelligent design movement is really how they understand this to work out in practice, the idea of tinkering with things in history, that sort of thing, which I find a little bit implausible. But the whole idea that there is a God, that this God initiated the process we call creation, and that in some way God's wisdom, God's rationality is expressed in that, that for me is just bread and butter. That's the way things are.
And you, it's what has been termed natural theology.
That's
and you,
right.
And you think that there is something of a revival going on in this area?
I think there is, particularly because so many natural scientists are asking these questions. What are our findings suggesting? What are contemporary understandings of the universe pointing to? And they're beginning to ask the metaphysical, the religious questions that actually would have been out of order a generation ago. So I find that very intriguing. Of course, the secularists are trying to clamp down on this very, very rigorously and aggressively, but it's not going to go away because these are legitimate, important questions and people want to ask them.
I mean, the arguments go, you know, there are these incredible fine-tuned constants which had to be in place at the very beginning of time and space, and it impacts all the way down to the very fact that evolution can take place. There has to be this incredible fine-tuning, and it seems to be begging for an explanation. Now, when I've had discussions with atheists on this level, they don't want, as it were, to concede the ground that there has to be some ultimate explanation. They say, why can't the universe itself be a good enough explanation? Isn't God just interposing some kind of explanation which you then can't explain? Isn't it just saying, isn't it an end effectively to science if we just say, I don't understand it, therefore God did it?
It may be that atheist scientists say that, but a lot of other scientists would not. This is an expression of atheism, not of science. What they seem to be saying, these atheists, is something like this: look, that's just the way the world is, we don't want to talk about it. There's no need to go behind that. But most scientists would say, no, we seek explanations. That's what science is all about. Why is the world the way it is? That is legitimate. If it is fine-tuned in this way, then that itself merits exploration. We can't just say, hey, that's the way it is, let's talk about something else. Why? Did it have to be this way? If not, how? These are very legitimate questions. And for me, you know, I look at biologists like Richard Dawkins, and they very often assume it's just so obvious that evolution could take place, we don't talk about it. In fact, if the chemistry of carbon had been slightly different, it could not have happened. So we do need to look about very carefully at the initial conditions of things. And I don't say this proves the existence of God, but it certainly resonates very strongly with what Christians have always said.
Your latest book is on the history of heresy, which is a fascinating issue. I mean, the word heresy conjures up perhaps medieval images of people being burned at the stake for believing in things that were different from the establishment and that sort of thing. What does the word mean to you? Do we need to rehabilitate it a bit?
I think we do need to rehabilitate it. The real problem is that in the Middle Ages, heresy changed its meaning. It became a religious teaching which either the church or the state found challenging. And of course, the easiest way of dealing with challenges is you lock them up or you burn them at the stake. You want to discourage other people from having these ideas. In this book called Heresy, what I tried to do is to ask, well, what is this idea? Where does it come from? Why has it become so sprinkled with stardust recently? You know, Dan Brown and Da Vinci Code and all the rest of them. And so what I tried to do is to actually ask, where does this idea come from? And really, what I argue is this in the book. I argue that the early church set out to say, let us give the best account possible of who Jesus Christ is, what God is like. And that meant exploring intellectual options. And sometimes these turned out to be dead ends. Looked good at the time, but didn't actually have staying power. And more than that, it wasn't just they weren't good enough. Actually, they were inadequate. So inadequate, they might even be destructive long term. In many ways, a heresy is an approach to Christian faith that is destructive. It looks okay at the time, but actually, in the longer term, it's simply inadequate as a basis for faith. And so in many ways, the quest for orthodoxy is the quest for the most authentic, reliable, trustworthy way of expressing the Christian faith. The church had to explore all the options, and some of those they had to say, look, sorry, there's a kind of no entry sign here, heresy. But others of them really worked well. That's orthodoxy.
Whereas I think many people have the idea, and very much because of the influence of people like Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, that what constitutes orthodox Christianity is the one that won. It's the, if you like, the version of events that kind of, you know, was given the stamp of approval at a council somewhere or by an emperor. I mean, is that the case, or is that a kind of just a misrepresentation of what actually happened?
Well, it is a bit of a misrepresentation. I mean, certainly Dan Brown in Da Vinci Code says, well, of course, the church decided by a very narrow vote that Jesus was divine. Well, I mean, historians have just ridiculed that. I mean, it's just untenable. Interestingly, the very first printing of the Da Vinci Code had the subtitle, A Novel. Now, that's been removed from later editions. And, of course, people love this sort of stuff. The idea the church has covered up secrets or suppressed something. You know, it's conspiracy theories, X-Files. So it really is very sexy for today's culture. The reality is rather different. And that is, it's very, very clear the church was reflecting what is the best way of making sense of things. When Constantine became converted, these questions began to have political importance. Yet, interestingly, to give you one example, Arianism, the idea Jesus is not God. I mean, the Council of Nicaea went for the idea Jesus is God, seeing this as obvious, and won the day. A later emperor said, no, we're going back to Arianism, I like that. But within a generation, the church had moved back. Even though this had been imposed by an emperor, it wasn't good enough. Actually, Dan Brown's theory, if anything, is saying that Arianism was something imposed by an emperor for his own convenience. Mm. But that's not the sort of thing Dan Brown really wants to say.
I mean, isn't there the danger here that one man's heresy is another man's fresh interpretation of the Christian faith? I mean, is it just different views on similar subjects?
I think the important thing about heresy is it's not an individual's judgment. It's not like me saying, oh, I don't like this very much, therefore it's a heresy. It's much more the whole church coming to a weighed, considered decision that actually this isn't right. It's not me, it's not you, it's the church. It's a corporate judgment. And sometimes that may take some time. So I think it is important to be aware that really the church has always welcomed what we might call fresh explorations. We've always got to ask, how do we best explain the significance of Christ? How do we best connect it with our culture and say this in ways it can understand? Sometimes it works very well. Sometimes we end up developing ideas that actually are unhelpful, even destructive. An idea that was meant to support faith actually turns out to erode it by weakening it or presenting it in a very inadequate way. I think we need to say heresy has ongoing significance because the church is always prone to develop bright new ideas which don't have staying power.
Well, we'll be back to finish up this interview with Alistair McGrath in just a moment's time, and then we'll be hearing some of your feedback to previous week's programming. Do join me again in a short moment. Welcome back to the programme. Before we hear the final few minutes of that interview with Alistair McGrath, let me tell you that next week on the programme, well, it's Interfaith Week, and we're going to be marking that by looking at what have been called the 10 Commandments of Interfaith Evangelism. This was a list of, if you like, rules for ethical witness between different faiths drawn up by a group called the Christian Muslim Forum. But not everyone agrees with the rules, saying that it will stifle freedom for criticism of another's religion. So I'm going to be joined by Christians on both sides of that debate, as well as Muslims and those of other faiths, as we look at this issue on how to disagree agreeably when it comes to sharing our faith. That's part of our coverage of Interfaith Week next week here on Premier.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Right now, time to listen to the final part of this interview with Alistair McGrath. And don't forget, coming up very shortly, we'll be hearing some of your response to the last few weeks of programming on Premier.
What then, for you, are the non-negotiables? Is there a list you have in your head of what are the non-negotiables of Christian belief? And if you say, if you phrase it in a different way, or you have a different idea on this, then you really are outside the bounds of orthodoxy.
I certainly would say that. I would not say it in an arrogant, imperialistic way. I'd simply say, look, I'm afraid this is the way it seems to me based on what I've looked at in church history and what I've thought about theologically. For me, a non-negotiable would be that there is a link, a very strong link, between God and Jesus Christ. You break that link, Christianity falls to pieces. And that actually lies behind so many heresies, that they want to break that link. For me, affirming that link, to have met Christ is to have met God. To have seen Christ is to have seen the Father. That seems to me to be integral to the way Christians think about Christ and about God.
What about, you know, the resurrection? Is that a non-negotiable? I mean, because different people might interpret it in different ways. Some might see it as a spiritual.
And I think there is always going to be a very proper debate about exactly what the word resurrection means. And certainly for Paul, whatever the resurrection was, it was non-negotiable. In 1 Corinthians 15, he's very, very clear about this. If it didn't happen, then we are the most miserable of people. What does resurrection designate? Does it simply mean the physical event of an empty tomb, resurrection appearances, or is it the interpretation of these? For me, the word resurrection is about things that happened, but also the theological interpretation accompanying them. Not simply Jesus' body had gone. The disciples began to experience him as being present in a very exciting and challenging way, but actually the interpretation of this as God having intervened to raise Christ up, to declare he is the Son of God, to vindicate him, and to say, in effect, this which happened to Christ will happen to all who put their trust in him. So for me, resurrection is not simply historical event. It's historical event rightly interpreted.
Those who would deny the historical aspect of it just want to give it a spiritual meaning, who would say that, you know, these really were mythological events, and that if there was any resurrection, it was really a spiritual type of, resurrection of the disciples' spirits or whatever, you know, that took place. But we don't have to believe in actual physical historical events here. Is that just sort of bowing to a kind of,
Enlightenment thinking, you know, that the miraculous really shouldn't figure anymore in our kind of theological thinking.
I think it is an accommodation of the idea of resurrection to cultural pressures. And I want to say, actually, that one element of the resurrection is indeed this spiritual transformation, but it's not the full story. And really what I would want to say is that we do need to tell the full story. We may need to recognize that our culture may not be ready to hear the full story. And we may need to tell them part of the story to get them interested and keep the rest of it for later. But certainly for me, a Christian theology is about telling the totality of what Christianity has to say.
You were describing how much you enjoy your job.
What's
the best thing about your job?
There are so many good things about my job. One of the things I love is where I'm trying to explain a point which is perhaps difficult but also important, and to see a student grasp it. Suddenly they see, that makes sense. I can do something with this. And that's when I feel I've actually been helpful to that person. I also find that my job, because it forced me to read so many theologians from the past and from the present, that actually I find myself constantly being enriched, being challenged. You know, my vision of the Christian gospel grows. I penetrate more deeply into its core. And the result is that very often I will read theologians that want to preach, and I find that very exciting. And I also enjoy working with colleagues. I'm part of a very good team, and there's a great esprit de corps, so I really enjoy that. But I think for me, the really exciting part of my job is the teaching bit. Seeing people beginning to realise what this is all about and wanting to go and do something about it.
You've been a major player in evangelical theology. You've written books on theology. What are the key challenges facing evangelicalism today, would you say?
I think there are some challenges it faces. I think I believe passionately that evangelicalism has the resources to meet these challenges. The question is whether it has the leadership to actually do that in the years that lie ahead. I think one of them is that there is always a temptation to go back into a safer place, to say, you know, if we could only go back to the 1950s, things would be easier. I'm afraid things have moved on and we just can't do that. We need to face up to the challenges today and not think that simply repeating yesterday's answers will satisfy today's questions. I think also, and I think this really is very important, that we do lack role models. I shall be speaking at an event to mark the final retirement of Michael Green in a few weeks' time. And I look at people like John Stott, Jim Packer, Michael Green, people who are now in their 80s. And I thank God for their leadership and their vision. But I wonder, is God missing out on a generation? Because I don't see people of that caliber behind them. I very much hope that a new generation of leaders is emerging and arising, because I don't think my generation really has done its job very well. So I'm very hopeful that a new generation will arise which is willing to face the challenges rather than simply look back to going back to safer places. Challenges, but resources as well.
What excites you then about the Christian world today? There are obviously challenges. What makes you excited about the things you see happening in the Christian church?
I'm very impressed by the vitality and maturity of Christian leaders from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America. That really excites me. And sometimes I think that we in Western Europe are going to have to learn a lot from the churches in the emerging world. In many ways, they've got a vision which could re-energize ours.
Finally, what do you hope to be remembered for when you do shuffle off this mortal coil? What do you hope people will say? Ah, yes, Alistair McGrath. He really such and such.
I doubt if I will be remembered at all.
I think that's a bit... I'm sure that's not true, Alistair.
No, I personally don't have any aspirations to being remembered. I think if anybody does remember me, I hope they might think, well, actually, he wrote a book which I found quite helpful in building up my faith. If anybody says that, I shall feel very happy.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you want to respond to anything you heard Alistair say, or just give your thoughts, you're welcome to email, of course. The usual address applies, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do check out the webpage, of course. This available as a podcast now if you want to listen back to it again, or send it on to a friend. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Again, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And there's a long archive of past programmes there for you to explore as well. And I do hope you enjoy listening to some of the varied topics that we've featured over the years on Unbelievable. Well, if you'd like to get in touch by phone at the moment, just to warn you that the option has changed on the line now. So if you're ringing for leaving a voicemail message for Unbelievable, you need to ring the same number, 08456 52 52 52, but select option 8. That's the option to leave your voicemail message on if you want to get in touch with the programme. Lots of people have been getting in touch with the programme, both by phone and email. And I'm going to start off a bulging mailbag of response to the edition of the programme last week, which featured controversial retired Episcopal US Bishop John Shelby Spong, Jack Spong, as he's more commonly known. He, if you like, is at the forefront of liberal Christianity, though some people have objected to him even wearing the title Christian. They say that's unsuitable. Some people also concerned that the response was not, if you like, strong enough to Spong. And I can understand that. As I said on the programme, there were many things he said which we simply would never have had time to respond to. I did encourage people to go and look at other programmes that deal with those issues in more depth. But let me start up with this one from David Robertson, who's well known as a guest on this programme. He says, to say I was disappointed at the latest Unbelievable programme with Bishop Spong and Terry Boyle would be the understatement of the year. Bishop Spong was, as I expected, he betrayed a theological, historical and biblical ignorance which was spectacular. Amongst many things, the false statements he made were that Christians worship the Bible, the Trinity was a 4th century doctrine, that Jesus could not be human if the Holy Spirit was his Father, that the Church encourages us to stay childlike, that the Bible teaches the Gospel is reward for good and punishment for evil, that the Church teaches sexual desire is evil, women are defined as subhuman in the Bible. He claimed to be a Trinitarian who did not believe in the Trinity. However, I found him to be arrogant, patronising and superior in a way I had not expected. But the real disappointment came in the responses. I realise you're the presenter and it wouldn't be right to weigh in on one side, but Terry, although he made some good points, didn't deal with the elephant in the room. This was simply that the programme was presented as a discussion between two Christians who just had different theological points of view. It should have been pointed out that Bishop Spong has no right to use the name Christian when he does not believe in or follow Jesus Christ, does not accept the Bible, or even believe in an all-powerful Almighty God. In what sense can he possibly be called a Christian? This was not two different views of theology. It was two different religions, one of which was Christianity and the other was man-made nonsense. I realise that we're supposed to be nice, but when people teach doctrines of demons, they should be called on it, says David. But thank you for listening, David. I know you do listen every week. Ken Miller in Benfleet says, as ever, I listened to the discussion between John Shelby Spong and Terry Boyle of Insight for Living with Interest, and Matthew 7:15 instantly came to mind. Be on your guard against false prophets. Bishop Spong's views are so radical that poor Terry Boyle didn't know where to start. He would have had to have countered the bishop's words line by line. Afterwards, I visited the bishop's website. I now know why the Episcopal Church of the USA and the worldwide Anglican community is in such a mess. Bishop Spong and his ilk are attempting to overturn 2,000 years of Christian orthodoxy. I pray they don't succeed. I do enjoy the programme. Keep up the good work, says Ken. Arnold over in Toronto says, great work. I really enjoyed the programme. I must say I was a bit puzzled that Mr. Boyle's apologetics consisted mostly of being offended and asking what's left if we take all that out. The fact is the church will continue to lose members until someone can intelligently reconcile original sin with evolution. Also, wasn't it odd that he was offended at the suggestion that Christianity treats its members like children? Yet he himself, a few minutes later, talking of Genesis, said God did not want us to make good or bad judgments for ourselves. He did said, don't eat the fruit of that tree because you are finite and I am not. That he doesn't see the irony there. Now, that is unbelievable. Well, just in defence quickly of Terry Boyle, who joined us for the last two programmes on Unbelievable. I mean, I think he would say immediately he's not an apologist by trade. He's a pastor, and in a sense, he was taking a pastorly approach in some sense on the programme. But I acknowledge that there are many who feel that, you know, the response could have been stronger. B.W. Gillespie wants to talk about the debate. He says, living on the other side of Galileo and the other side of Darwin, as Bishop Spong put it, seeing humanity in the long run of evolution, programmed for survival, as he has repeatedly stressed, in no way says that we are whole or perfect, nor does it negate the idea of our being fallen and prone to failure. Else, why would we need to evolve further? Nor does it take away the responsibility of our choices. If we find a genetic sequence that predisposes me to be a killer, that will not make murder justifiable for me. We choose, and we can choose wrongly. We are capable of creating evil. To say that recognizing our fallenness and seeing its solution in Christ fosters guilt is quite the opposite to common experience. I know that I fail. I fail daily, and I fail deeply. To deny so would be rank self-delusion. What I find again and again is that recognizing my failings and turning to Christ and his work on the cross makes me whole, releases my spirit, lifts my heart, disposes of guilt, and enables me to live immeasurably more fully than I can ever do when I choose to ignore my shortcomings or God's gracious love. Well, there's just a few emails to get us started. Let's have some of your phone comments now in regard to that conversation. Let me remind you that the discussion topic we were calling, do we need to transcend traditional Christian beliefs, which is certainly the way that Jack Spong sees it. Obviously, arguing against that was Terry Boyle, arguing that actually when you strip out the supernatural aspects, as Jack was wanting to do, from Christianity, you really are left with nothing, or whatever you are left with is very ineffectual as far as dealing with the human condition. Here's some of your responses to the whole debate.
When the person that has been discussing on the issue of Jesus transcending, if he says that Jesus did not come to rescue sinners, and to rescue us, what would he say about the fact when Jesus said he came for the sinners and not for the righteous? I would like that comment. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Hi. I think the deliberate inconsistencies of the Bible enable us to not profess our own demonic intelligence on reality, but to surrender our egos to that greater truth that is God through Jesus. Thank you. Bye.
Hello. My name is Rebecca. The man who is arguing for Bible Belt Christianity being hatred and all the rest of it, if you want to point to true biblical Christianity that changes our humanity, he should read the books on the Welsh revival. A lot of people who were living sinful lives became Christians. Pubs were closing down because people didn't see the need to carry on in their sinful lives. That's what I call true Christianity. The Bible says, by their fruits, we shall know them.
Well, thank you for those different points of view. And it's interesting to hear all the different things that people have been responding to during the course of that debate, because so many things were mentioned. Let's keep going and get through a few more of your emails on this. This one from Alan says, where does Jack get the idea the Trinity arose in the 4th century? It was in the Gospels and with the early Christians from day one. It was merely clarified in the 4th century. You also want to say that the Gospels were written after Paul. I don't think so, he says. My dear Theophilus, Luke means the Gospel of Luke was written within 4 years of Jesus' crucifixion, says Alan. You say Jack Spong is a dyed-in-the-wool evolutionist, and his views show the danger of swallowing the ridiculous notion that one creature's DNA can evolve by random damage into another creature. He has left nothing in the Christian faith undamaged, says Alan. This from Pauli says, given his view about God being beyond human description by words, Mr. Spong seems to know a whole lot about what God is or isn't. And furthermore, you say statistics would seem to bear out that if there is any form of Christianity that must change or die, to quote Spong's book title, it seems to be liberal Christianity rather than the more traditional or evangelical variety. Avril says, most interesting listening, been a keen fan of Unbelievable and have listened to many of your broadcasts. I noticed that many of your guests, including Bishop Jack, appear to have one thing in common. Many appear to have had unhelpful Christian backgrounds. I hear from them God is like an ogre in the sky or a nasty grandfather with a big stick. Unfortunately, when a child hears such a message, it often sticks and messes up their lives, especially if there's no one able to teach them the alternative, i.e. a loving, forgiving God who cares so much for them that he died for them and in whom they can trust. I did also resent Bishop Jack's view that all evangelical Christians are like little children. I found that really patronizing and complete nonsense. And finally, you say here, Avril, I'm really sad that his experience of fundamental Christianity in the Bible Belt has left him in such a mess. Unfortunately, it's not an excuse for coming up with an alternative Christianity. The early church had the same problem. Paul wrote in 2 Timothy chapter 4, "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers and will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. It makes me more determined to reach out and tell the world what a wonderful, forgiving and loving God we have who sets us free from guilt and fear, loves and cherishes us so much that he died for us." Over in Florida, Elaine wants to say, "Spong says he loves the Bible, but as he refers to its various parts, he continually belittles its inferred message. The very way that he talks gives evidence of the results of this. For instance, I can hear in Pastor Terry a listening to the Spirit before he says each word. It's evident that this ability to listen to the Spirit is completely void in the way that Spong talks about the Bible and the Christian faith, for there's no evident conscience towards either of them. Also, using Spong's idea of evolving and his relying heavily on some solid evolution generated by Darwin, he utterly does away with Jesus Christ, who in his own estimation had been able to bring human evolvement into its perfection. Well, if Darwin is such a settling figure for humankind, then Jesus Christ was not truly the perfect human being Spong believes him to be. Jesus Christ did not bring this Darwinian message to mankind, and yet Spong thinks Jesus Christ represents perfect man." And finally, Christopher in Slovakia says, "I was able to listen to parts of the recent program, which engaged the preterist and liberal positions. It made rewarding listening, but only in the bankruptcy of busily reading the scriptures, relying on one's own intellect, but without the Spirit of God, became plainly evident to me. Sects are born this way, and I fear for those who dare to suggest, in effect, that God might need help reaching those who cannot accept the cross of his Son and the gospel of salvation. They are without excuse. I believe this verse applies. The unspiritual man does not receive the gifts of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. And I pray for those who advanced these positions on the program." Well, there you are. Something of the response we received in to that program, and many of you wanted to put your points of view across on that. Well, we still haven't managed to get round to reading some of and playing out some of the responses to the program before that of a few weeks back. That was on preterism and how we reconcile things like the return of Jesus with what appeared to be him suggesting that it would be immediate in the lifetime of his followers. Here's a couple of your phone calls in regard to that particular program.
My name is Jean. The discussion that's going on at the moment regarding Matthew, I've had that same thought or concern for a while, wondering when Jesus will return. I've always believed that Jesus will return one day, but I've also had another belief, and that is that when people are dying, just before their death, that believers, they actually see Jesus coming in the cloud. I've watched a few people who have died, Christians, and the smile that comes on their face, I feel pretty sure that they're actually seeing Jesus just before they pass away.
Yeah, hi Justin, it's John ringing from South London. I can't understand Dee Dee and Andrew's theology, thinking, etc. So, to a certain extent I do. Before I became a Christian and when I became a Christian, I used to read Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, and since hearing Dr. Jack Graham, Dr. Liam Gallagher, Brian Broderson of Calvary Chapel Ministries, these preachers and other preachers, it's quite plain to see that Christ is not yet returned. He will return at the end of the age to judge the living and the dead, to judge the nations who will stand before him. Regarding the word dispensationalist, I never thought I was one. You know, it's just a word, but I believe what Terry said. Thank the Lord you had him on the show to put the truth, the accurate truth.
And thanks to others who have been emailing as well in response to that programme. You may remember we had what's called the Preterist View, represented by D.D. Warren. John in Texas emails in to say, I just finished listening to the podcast on eschatology and enjoyed it. I do, however, believe you are missing the one view that answers most of the questions that were left unanswered by your guests. As I too struggled with this topic, I was introduced to the full preterist view that honours all the time statements and imminency that dominates the New Testament. It was mostly through the writings of Don Preston and others that I was able to come to grips with the difficult passages on eschatology. Despite D.D. Warren's hatred of full preterists and her claims to the contrary, I am a Christian and have been for many years. I'm a Reformed Southern Baptist, so unless D.D. believes one can lose their salvation by changing one's views of eschatology, I remain a believer. I had written to you about a month or so ago recommending a guest on this topic and will do so again. Well, that's an interesting point of view, and having read what full preterism does believe, it might make an interesting one to maybe bring you and D.D. on again, or someone, John. But thanks for your message. Would love to read some more emails, but no time at the moment. So I said I would get to your email, John, on missionaries, which relates to somewhat the discussion between a Hindu and Christian we had a few weeks ago. Well, I'll bring that next week, because it will also actually tie in quite well to the subject of next week's programme. So let me tell you about that. But before I do, if you want to get in touch again in response to today's programme or anything you heard in the feedback as well, you're welcome to do so. The usual address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you'd like to phone, 08456 52 52 52. And now select option 8. Option 8 from this week onwards. Okay, thanks for listening. Do come back again next week. Let me tell you what's happening on the programme then. You're unbelievable. Well, it's going to be the UK's first Interfaith Week next week, and we're looking at the 10 Commandments of Interfaith Evangelism. This was drawn up by a group of Muslims and Christians. Not everyone agrees with the rules, though, saying that they could stifle the freedom to criticise another's religion. We'll be hearing that discussion between a couple of Christians, a Muslim, and a people of other faiths as we look at this issue in Interfaith Week. How to disagree agreeably when it comes to sharing our faith with people of other faiths. That's the topic next week. Do hope you can join me for it. And don't forget, plenty more to come on Premier this afternoon. Keep listening. The very best place for Christian music, news and chat. Thanks for joining me on the programme today. And don't forget to listen again online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.